The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi everybody, this is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the A Critic at Large section of the February 6, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, When Americans Lost Faith in the News. Half a century ago, most of the public said they trusted the news media. Today, most say they don't. What happened to the power of the press? By Louis Menand. When the Washington Post unveiled the slogan "Democracy Dies in Darkness" on February 17, 2017, people in the news business made fun of it. Sounds like the next Batman movie, the New York Times executive editor Dean Baquet said, but it was already clear, less than a month into the Trump administration, that destroying the credibility of the mainstream press was a White House priority, and that this would include an unabashed and almost gleeful policy of lying and denying. The Post kept track of the lies. The paper calculated that by the end of his term, the president had lied 30,573 times. Almost as soon as Donald Trump took office, he started calling the news media, quote, the enemy of the American people, end quote. For a time, the White House barred certain news organizations, including the Times, CNN, Politico, and the Los Angeles Times, from briefings and suspended the credentials of a CNN correspondent, Jim Acosta, who was regarded as combative by the president. Fake news became a standard White House response, frequently the only White House response to stories that did not make the president look good. There were many such stories. Suspicion is, for obvious reasons, built into the relationship between the press and government officials. But normally, both parties have felt an interest in maintaining at least the appearance of cordiality. Reporters need access so that they can write their stories, and politicians would like those stories to be friendly. Reporters also want to come across as fair and impartial, and officials want to seem cooperative and transparent. Each party is willing to accept a degree of hypocrisy on the part of the other. With Trump, all that changed. Trump is rude. Cordiality is not a feature of his brand. And there is no cooperation in the Trump world, because everything is an agon. Trump waged war on the press, and he won, or nearly won. He persuaded millions of Americans not to believe anything they saw or heard in the non-Trumpified media, including, ultimately, the results of the 2020 presidential election. The press wasn't silenced in the Trump years. The press was discredited, at least among Trump supporters, and that worked just as well. It was censorship by other means. Back in 1976, even after Vietnam and Watergate, 72% of the public said they trusted the news media. Today, the figure is 34%. Among Republicans, it's 14%. If democracy dies in darkness seemed a little alarmist in 2017, the storming of the Capitol on January 6, 2021 made it seem prescient. Democracy really was at stake. That we need a free press for our democracy to work is a belief as old as our democracy, hence the First Amendment. Without the free circulation of information and opinion, voters will be operating in ignorance when they choose whom to vote for and what policies to support. But what if the information is bad? What if you can't trust the reporter? What if there's no such thing as the facts? As Michael Shudson pointed out in Discovering the News in 1978, the notion that good journalism is objective, that is, nonpartisan and unopinionated, emerged only around the start of the 20th century. Shudson thought that it arose as a response to growing skepticism about the whole idea of stable and reliable truths. The standard of objectivity, as he put it, quote, was not the final expression of a belief in facts, but the assertion of a method designed for a world in which even facts could not be trusted. Journalists came to believe in objectivity to the extent that they did because they wanted to, needed to, were forced by ordinary human aspiration to seek escape from their own deep convictions of doubt and drift. End quote. In other words, objectivity was a problematic concept from the start. The classic statement of the problem is Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, published 101 years ago. Lippmann's critique remains relevant today. The Columbia Journalism School mounted a four-day conference on public opinion last fall, and people found that there was still plenty to talk about. Lippmann's argument was that journalism is not a profession. You don't need a license or an academic credential to practice the trade. All sorts of people call themselves journalists. Are all of them providing the public with reliable and disinterested news goods? Yet journalists are quick to defend anyone who uncovers and disseminates information as long as it's genuine, by whatever means and with whatever motives. Julian Assange is possibly a criminal. He certainly intervened in the 2016 election, allegedly with Russian help, to damage the candidacy of Hillary Clinton, but top newspaper editors have insisted that what Assange does is protected by the First Amendment, and the Committee to Protect Journalists has protested the charges against him. Lippmann had another point. Journalism is not a public service, it's a business. The most influential journalists today are employees of large corporations, and their work product is expected to be profitable. The notion that television news is, or ever was, a loss leader is a myth. In the 1960s, the nightly Huntley-Brinkley Report was NBC's biggest moneymaker. 60 Minutes, which debuted on CBS in 1968, ranked among the top 10 most watched shows on television for 23 years in a row. And the business is all about the eyeballs. When ratings drop, and with them advertising revenues, correspondents change, anchors change, coverage changes. News, especially but not only cable news, is curated for an audience. So obviously, is the information published on social media where the algorithm selects for the audience's political preferences? It's hard to be objective and sell news at the same time. What is the track record of the press since Lippmann's day? In City of Newsmen, Public Lies and Professional Secrets in Cold War Washington, published by Chicago, Catherine J. McGar weighs the performance of the Washington Press Corps during the first decades of the Cold War. She shows, by examining archived correspondence, that reporters in Washington knew perfectly well that administrations were misleading them about national security matters, about whether the United States was flying spy planes over the Soviet Union, for example, or training exiles to invade Cuba and depose Fidel Castro. To the extent that there was an agenda concealed by official claims of containing communist expansion, to the extent that Middle East policy was designed to preserve Western access to oil fields, or that Central American policy was designed to make the region safe for the United Fruit Company, reporters were not fooled. So why didn't they report what they knew? McGar, a historian at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, thinks it's because the people who covered Washington for the wire services and the major dailies had an ideology. They were liberal internationalists. Until the United States intervened militarily in Vietnam, the Marines waded ashore there in 1965, that was the ideology of American elites, like the government and like the leaders of philanthropy such as the Ford Foundation and cultural institutions such as the Museum of Modern Art. Newspaper people believed in what they saw as a central mission of Cold War policy, the defense of the North Atlantic community of nations. They supported policies that protected and promoted the liberal values in the name of which the United States had gone to war against Hitler. Many members of the Washington Press, including editors and publishers, had served in the government during the Second World War, in the Office of Strategic Services, the forerunner of the CIA, in the Office of War Information, and in other capacities in Washington and London. They had been part of the war effort, and their sense of duty persisted after the war ended. Defending democracy was not just the government's job, it was the press's job, too. When reporters were in possession of information that the American government wanted to keep secret, they therefore asked themselves whether publishing it would damage the Cold War mission. Fighting for peace remained central to the diplomatic press corps' conception of its responsibilities, McGar says. Quality reporting meant being an advocate not for the government, but for the peace. There was another reason for caution, fear of nuclear war. After the Soviets developed an atomic weapon in 1949, and until the Test Ban Treaty of 1963, end-of-the-world nuclear anxiety was widespread and newsmen shared it. The Cold War was a balance of power war. That's what the unofficial doctrine of the American government, containment, meant. Keep things as they are. Whatever tipped the scale in the wrong direction might unleash the bomb, and so newspapers were careful about what they published. McGar also makes it clear that the Washington Press was a case of what Timothy Krause, in his classic book on the 1972 presidential campaign, The Boys on the Bus, called pack journalism. Even though newspapers were nominally in competition with one another, reporters and editors were subject to what McGar calls horizontal pressure. Pressure to remain on good terms with their sources and their fellow newsmen. There was nothing like a firewall between government officials and the press. On the contrary, reporters and officials socialized frequently. This echo chamber was peopled almost exclusively by white men. Between 1945 and 1975, there was one woman in the cabinet and one black person. Each served for 2 years. On the press side, it was worse. Female and black reporters were programmatically excluded. They had no entree to certain press functions, and editors did not assign women to cover government affairs. Flat-out racism and sexism persisted much longer than seems believable today. The two main social organizations for Washington journalists were the Gridiron Club, founded in 1885, and the National Press Club, founded in 1908. The Gridiron invited members' wives to a dinner in 1896, but a skit lampooning the suffrage movement did not go over well, and the women were not allowed back until 1972. Into the 1950s, members performed in blackface for entertainment at Gridiron dinners. McGar reports that the club's signature tune was the Watermelon Song, sung in dialect. The National Press Club did not have a black member until 1955, which was the first year that women were allowed to attend luncheons where members were briefed by officials. The women had to sit in the balcony and were not allowed to ask questions. The National Press Club did not have a woman member until 1971. The Washington Post hired its first black reporter in 1951. He was assigned his own bathroom and left the paper after 2 years. McGar says that the Post did not hire another black reporter until 1972, but that's incorrect. The paper hired Dorothy Gilliam in 1961 and Jack White in 1968. Far into the civil rights movement, the Times had very few black reporters. The record of general interest magazines, including this one, was hardly better. City of Newsmen is a corrective to the tendency, which arose in the 1960s and has been stubbornly persistent, to reduce everything in the pre-Vietnam period to an obsession with communism and a blind faith in American exceptionalism. It wasn't that simple. McGar is doing what historians should do. She is clarifying the backstory. Still, a big piece is missing from it. Revelations about the CIA's covert involvement in what were ostensibly non-governmental organizations began in 1966, soon after the Marines landed in Vietnam, events that triggered a radical mood shift in American political life and a major change in government-press relations. It turned out that the agency had its tentacles everywhere, supporting, through cutouts and dummy foundations, organizations whose anti-communist agendas it wished to promote, and planting agents wherever it could. One of the places was the news media. In 1977, Carl Bernstein published an article in Rolling Stone in which he claimed that more than 400 journalists had worked clandestinely for the CIA since 1952. Major news organizations, Bernstein said that the most valuable were the Times, CBS, and Time, gave credentials to CIA agents to use as cover in foreign countries, sold outtakes from their reports to the agency, and allowed reporters to be debriefed by CIA officials. Soon after Bernstein's piece appeared, the Times ran its own investigative story in which it reported that the CIA had owned or subsidized, quote, more than 50 newspapers, news services, radio stations, periodicals, and other communications entities, end quote, mostly abroad, and that more than 30 and perhaps as many as 100 American journalists worked as salaried intelligence operatives while performing their reportorial duties. In 1980, Harrison Salisbury, a veteran Times man, published a book on the paper, Without Fear or Favor, in which he reported that one of the Times' European correspondents, C.L. Sulzberger, a nephew of the publisher, had met roughly once a month with CIA agents to trade information. Bernstein had also named Sulzberger as an agency asset. Sulzberger was furious. He did not think that he was an agent or an asset, or that he had anything to explain or apologize for. As he saw it, he was just a reporter talking to a government source. "I got a good deal more out of the CIA than it got out of me," he wrote in an unpublished response to Salisbury's book. The columnist Joseph Alsop was even more unapologetic. "I'm proud they asked me, and proud to have done it," he told Bernstein about his undercover work for the agency. "The notion that a newspaper man doesn't have a duty to his country is perfect balls." The Times seemed to feel that the issue was whether journalists who were involved with the CIA wrote propaganda, whether they deliberately spun their stories to the agency's liking. This misses the ethical point. What those reporters gave to the CIA was information they did not or could not publish. This meant that they were communicating things that they had been told on background or off the record by people who had no idea they were, in essence, talking to the American government. Even if the reporters kept their story's identity secret, and it is impossible to know now just what was said to whom, they were selling them out. By the summer of 1968, when the Democratic National Convention was held in Chicago, the Cold War modus vivendi had largely been shredded. Reporters felt that they were being used to publish the White House's lies about the progress of the war in Vietnam, and they struck back. Even before the convention began, the Times, the Wall Street Journal, CBS, and NBC had run stories saying that the war was unwinnable, in contradiction to what the Johnson administration was telling the people. So when the convention was being planned, Lyndon Johnson did not attend, having withdrawn from the race in March, but he was very much in charge. When it was being planned, pains were taken to incommode the news media as much as possible. The story of the 1968 convention, where Johnson's Vice President Hubert Humphrey won the nomination despite not having entered a single primary, and where the party's anti-war forces were defeated at almost every turn while police and the National Guard manhandled demonstrators and cameramen in the streets, and two correspondents, Dan Rather and Mike Wallace, were roughed up by security on the convention floor, has been told many times. When the news broke, Chicago 1968 and the polarizing of America, by the MIT media and historian Heather Hendershot, takes us through that story once again, virtually hour by hour, from the point of view of the networks. CBS, anchored by Walter Cronkite, whose sign-off was, "And that's the way it is." NBC, featuring the buddy act of Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, whose night sign-off was, "Good night, Chet. Good night, David." And ABC, which, as the runt of the broadcast litter, could not afford complete coverage, and so offered viewers commentary by Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley instead, which provided a semi-farcical subplot to the main event. As Hendershot puts it, ABC, quote, "did not demonstrate a commitment to elevating the level of television discourse," end quote. She doesn't mention that Buckley called Vidal a queer on the air. The mayor of Chicago, Richard J. Daley, was at heart a Kennedy man, but he was happy to help the president out. When the press arrived in town, they were confronted by a staggering array of inconveniences, some of them happenstance. There was a taxi strike. There was also an electrician strike, which meant that not enough telephones had been installed. During the convention, payphones became choked with dimes as reporters tried to file. The news networks were each allowed only one mobile camera on the convention floor and just 7 press passes, which had to suffice for both television and radio coverage. Television cameras were not allowed on the streets, which meant that when the police violence occurred, coverage had to be delayed while 16mm movie film was processed. The Battle of Michigan Avenue, as it came to be known, took place around 8 p.m. on August 28th, the third night of the convention. The demonstrators were planning to march from Grant Park to the convention hall, 5 miles away, when they were attacked in front of the Hilton Hotel, where Eugene McCarthy, the leading anti-war candidate, and Humphrey had their headquarters. Police charged into the crowd, clubbing marchers indiscriminately and arresting more than 1,000. The battle lasted just 17 minutes. By the time film could be processed and shown on the air, about an hour later, the mayhem was over. The news anchors maintained a posture of disinterestedness. They did not cover up the police violence, but they did not take the side of the demonstrators either. The rioting was a story. They reported it. If anything, they underreported it. In a great book on the post-war era, America in Our Time, the English journalist Godfrey Hodgson calculated that CBS had 38 hours of coverage at the convention, only 32 minutes of which were devoted to the protesters, and that NBC had 19 hours of coverage with only 14 minutes devoted to the protesters. Hendershot's numbers are slightly different, but not much, and she agrees that images of the demonstrators hardly dominated network coverage. Yet somehow Daley and the Democratic Party managed to convince viewers that the press was to blame for what they saw. People had not been shown what really happened. They should not believe what appeared on television or what the anchorman told them. Fake news. Anti-war delegates blamed Daley, the cops for his. But the day after the Battle of Michigan Avenue, Cronkite interviewed Daley on the air and was almost fawning. Cronkite opened the interview with, "I can tell you this, Mr. Daley, that you have a lot of supporters around the country as well as in Chicago," and proceeded to let Daley accuse reporters who had been beaten of being plants of the anti-war movement. Cronkite's biographer, Douglas Brinkley, no relation to David, calls the interview beyond lame. Daley was happy to take responsibility for a few cracked heads. He knew that the public would be on his side. The vast majority of Americans had no love for high-profile protesters like Abby Hoffman and Allen Ginsberg. They were happy to see them and their followers get knocked around. People did not fault the mayor or the police for what had happened. They faulted the press. Letters poured in accusing the networks of biased coverage. Hendershot quotes a typical one from an Air Force colonel. "Bravo, bravo, bravo. Your treatment of the yippies, hippies, junkies, hoodlums, bums, and other scum during the recent convention was perfect. I noted with delight that the police devoted some richly deserved attention to the prime provocateurs, the press." End quote. Mail to CBS ran 11-1 against the coverage. Mail to Daley, he claimed, was overwhelmingly positive. The historian David Farber, in his book about the convention, Chicago 68, reports that only 10% of whites polled said that they thought that Mayor Daley used too much force. Even among opponents of the war, more than 70% reacted negatively to the protesters. Still, it's notable that Daley was able to pin all the blame on the press. Walter Cronkite and Chet Huntley were no radicals. They were much more outspoken about the way the media was treated at the convention than about what happened to the demonstrators. The networks generally operated with tremendous fairness in Chicago, Hendershot writes, and attacks after the fact were unwarranted. Yet, she believes that Chicago was a tipping point for widespread distrust of the mainstream media. The loss of trust was taken advantage of by Republican politicians. They could see that demonizing the press was good politics. Richard Nixon, elected 9 weeks after Chicago went to war against the media. His administration not only attacked the mainstream press rhetorically, in incendiary speeches by the Vice President Spiro Agnew, it also went after the networks by having the Federal Communications Commission look into antitrust violations. This was the network's greatest nightmare. Broadcast television had been an oligopoly from the start. An antitrust case was easy to make, and the FCC proceeded to limit the amount of control the networks had over primetime programming, which allowed Hollywood to get into the television production business. The network era was coming to an end. The medium got the message. After Chicago, as Hodgson explains, coverage of political unrest, the civil rights movement, and the war was vastly reduced. By the end of 1970, people had almost forgotten about Vietnam, although Americans continued to die there for 5 more years, partly because they were seeing and reading much less about it. The networks understood that most viewers did not want to see images of wounded soldiers or anti-war protesters or inner-city rioters. They also understood that the government held, as it always had, the regulatory hammer. Hendershot's argument seems to be missing a step, though. If the coverage in Chicago was, to borrow with tongs, the slogan of Fox News, fair and balanced, why did the public feel differently? It would make sense for the press to lose credibility if it had been delivering biased or sensationalized news, but it hadn't. It had barely covered the protesters at all. Something else was going on. That something was the war. Vietnam was the beginning of our present condition of polarization, and one of the features of polarization is that there is no such thing as objectivity or impartiality anymore. In a polarized polity, either you're with us or you're against us. You can't be disinterested because everyone knows that disinterestedness is a facade. Viewers in 1968 did not want fair and balanced. They wanted the press to condemn the kids with long hair giving cops the finger. We are still there today. It is said that objectivity is what we need more of, but that's not what people want. What people want is advocacy. The balance between belief and skepticism that Shudson described has tipped. It is understood now that everyone has an agenda, even Dr. Fauci. Especially Dr. Fauci, since he keeps talking about science. We say that we want the Supreme Court to be apolitical and to follow the law. But what we really want is for the court to come out our way. In the end, we don't care what the facts are because there are always more facts. You can't unspin the facts. You can only put a different spin on them. What we want is to see our enemy, Steve Bannon, Hunter Biden, whomever, in an orange jumpsuit. We want winners and losers. That is why much of our politics now takes place in a courtroom. In the memoir/manifesto, Newsroom Confidential Lessons and Worries from an Ink-Stained Life, published by St. Martin's, Margaret Sullivan argues that objectivity is not so much impossible today as meaningless, and that the press ought to stop striving to achieve it. The events of 2020 and 21 showed that the press's values were in the wrong place. The extreme right wing had its staunch all-in media allies, she writes. The rest of the country had a mainstream press that too often couldn't or wouldn't do their jobs. Too many journalists couldn't seem to grasp their crucial role in American democracy. Sullivan has had a distinguished career. She was the first woman editor of the Buffalo News, her hometown paper, and then became the first woman public editor at the Times. The public editor, a position now discontinued, responded to issues with the paper's coverage. From 2016, the year of Trump's election, until she retired in 2022, she was a media columnist for the Washington Post. Journalism is her beat. She complains about a number of common journalistic practices, the use of anonymous sources, for example. But what concerns her most is precisely the objectivity standard. She thinks this leads to both sides-ism, the insistence on giving each party in a dispute equal coverage, as CBS did with Mayor Daley in Chicago. In her view, the traditional news media engaged in a pattern of treating election denialists as, quote, legitimate news sources whose views, for the sake of objectivity and fairness, must be respectfully listened to and reflected in news stories, end quote. And this was true of the mainstream coverage of national politics generally. Almost pathologically, Sullivan says, reporters normalize the abnormal and sensationalize the mundane. An example is the Clinton email story, when, just 11 days before the 2016 election, the FBI director James Comey announced that some of the emails Clinton wrote when she was Secretary of State had been found on the laptop of Anthony Weiner, the disgraced former New York City mayoral candidate. The Times went into overdrive. In 6 days, the paper ran as many cover stories about Clinton's emails as it had about all the policy issues combined in the 69 days leading up to the election. This coverage set the tone for the rest of the mainstream media, which proceeded to pile on. That Clinton was somehow a criminal for doing what her predecessor, Colin Powell, had also done, conduct government business using a private server, was a staple of the Trump campaign, which welcomed, of course, the release of Democratic National Committee emails by Assange. The email story was defined by a hacker and a liar, and the press played along. Why did the news overcover the email stories? In the name, Sullivan thinks, a balance. The paper did not want to appear pro-Clinton. The Times' promise seemed to be, yes, never fear, Hillary Clinton will be the next president, but our readers will have an exaggerated sense of her flaws when she takes the oath of office. Let it never be said we gave her preferential treatment. Comey was presumably operating from similar motives. Sullivan's conclusion that the press should take sides put her in conflict with the Washington Post editor during the Trump years, Martin Barron. She quotes from an email he sent to her. When we've done our work with requisite rigor and thoroughness, also known as solid objective reporting, we should tell people what we've learned and what remains unknown, directly, straightforwardly, unflinchingly, just as people in lots of other professions do when they're doing their jobs correctly. That's what objectivity was intended to mean when the term was developed for journalism more than a century ago. That is, when Lippmann wrote Public Opinion. Sullivan's position is an appeal to the original rationale of the First Amendment. We have a free press in order to protect democracy. When democracy is threatened, reporters and editors and publishers should have an agenda. They should be pro-democracy. Reporters should stop asking who the winners and losers are, Sullivan says. They should start asking who is serving democracy and who is undermining it. The press is in the game. It has a stake. But the Cold War era press thought it had a critical agenda, too. That agenda led many of its members to conceal actions of the government that the world now knows about and that Americans now regret. And it led a few of them to act as spies and informants rather than as journalists. The power of the press, such as it is like the power of academic scholars, scientific researchers, and Supreme Court justices. It is not backed by force. It rests on faith. The belief that these are groups of people dedicated to pursuing the truth without fear or favor. Once they disclaim that function, they will be perceived in the way everyone else is now perceived, as spinning for gain or status. And now from the Annals of Psychology section of the February 13 and 20, 2023 issue of The New Yorker, Why Everyone Feels Like They're Faking It. The concept of imposter syndrome has become ubiquitous. Critics and even the idea's originators question its value, by Leslie Jameson. Long before Pauline Clance developed the idea of the imposter phenomenon, now, to her frustration, more commonly referred to as imposter syndrome, she was known by the nickname Tiny. Born in 1938 and raised in Baptist Valley in Appalachian, Virginia, she was the youngest of six children, the daughter of a sawmill operator who struggled to keep food on the table and gas in the tank of his timber truck. Tiny was ambitious. Her photograph appeared in the local newspaper after she climbed onto a table to deliver her rebuttal during a debate tournament. But she was always second-guessing herself. After nearly every test she took, and usually aced, she would tell her mother, "I think I failed it." She was shocked when she beat the football team captain for class president. She was the first in her family to go to college. A high school counselor warned her, "You'll be doing well if you get C's," after which she earned a Ph.D. in psychology at the University of Kentucky. But everywhere she went, Clance felt the same nagging sense of self-doubt, the suspicion that she'd somehow tricked everyone else into thinking she belonged. In the early 70s, as an assistant professor at Oberlin College, Clance kept hearing female students confessing experience that reminded her of her own. They were sure they'd failed exams, even if they always did well. They were convinced that they'd been admitted because there had been an error on their test scores, that they'd fooled authority figures into thinking they were smarter than they actually were. Clance began comparing notes with one of her colleagues, Suzanne Imes, about their shared feelings of fraudulence. Imes had grown up in Abilene, Texas, with an older sister who early on had been deemed the smart one. As a high schooler, Imes had confessed anxieties to her mother that sounded exactly like the ones Clance had to hers. Imes particularly remembered crying after a Latin test, telling her mother, "I know I failed." Among other things, she'd forgotten the word for farmer. When it turned out that she'd got an A, her mother said, "I never want to hear about this again." But her accomplishment did not make the feelings go away. It only made her stop talking about them until she met Clance. One evening, they threw a party for some of the Oberlin students, complete with strobe lights and dancing. But the students looked disappointed and said, "We thought we were going to be learning something." They were hypervigilant, so intent on staving off the possibility of failure that they couldn't let loose for even a night. So Clance and Imes turned the party into a class, setting up a circle of chairs and encouraging the students to talk. After some of them confessed that they felt like imposters among their brilliant classmates, Clance and Imes started referring to the feelings they were observing as the imposter phenomenon. The pair spent 5 years talking to more than 150 successful women, students and faculty members at several universities, professionals in fields including law, nursing, and social work. Then they recorded their findings in a paper, "The Imposter Phenomenon in High-Achieving Women, Dynamics and Therapeutic Intervention." They wrote that women in their sample were particularly prone to, quote, "an internal experience of intellectual phoniness," end quote, living in perpetual fear that, quote, "some significant person will discover that they are indeed intellectual imposters," end quote. But it was precisely this process of discovery that had helped Clance and Imes formulate the concept, as they recognized feelings in each other and in their students that they'd been experiencing all their lives. At first, the paper kept getting rejected. "Weirdly, we didn't get imposter feelings about that," Clance told me when I visited her at her home in Atlanta. "We believed in what we were trying to say." It was eventually published in 1978 in the journal Psychotherapy, Theory, Research, and Practice. The paper spread like an underground zine. People kept writing to Clance to ask for copies, and she sent out so many that the person working the copy machine in her department asked, "What are you doing with all these?" For decades, Clance and Imes saw their concepts steadily gain traction. In 1985, Clance published a book, The Imposter Phenomenon, and also released an official IP scale for researchers to license for use in their own studies. But it wasn't until the rise of social media that the idea, by now rebranded as imposter syndrome, truly exploded. Almost 50 years after its formulation, the concept has achieved a level of cultural saturation that Clance and Imes never imagined. Clance maintains a list of studies and articles that have referenced their original idea. It is now more than 200 pages long. The concept has inspired a micro-industry of self-help books. The phrase imposter syndrome often elicits a fierce sense of identification, especially from millennial and Gen X women. When I put out a call on Twitter for experiences of imposter syndrome, I was flooded with responses. Do you have room in your inbox for roughly 180,000 words? A high-level publishing executive wrote. A graduate of Trinity College, Dublin confessed that her feelings of fraudulence were so strong that she'd been unable to enter the college's library for her entire first year. A university administrator said, I grew up on a pig farm in rural Illinois. Whenever I attended a fancy event, even if it is one I am producing, I feel like people will still see hayseed in my hair. An artisanal cider maker wrote, I've made endless ciders, but each and every time that I start fermenting, my mind goes, oh, this is the one when everyone will find out you don't know what you're doing. The eminent are not immune. In fact, Clance and Imes argued forcefully in their original study that success was not a cure. Maya Angelou once said, I have written 11 books, but each time I think, uh-oh, they're going to find out now. I've run a game on everybody, and they're going to find me out. Neil Gaiman, in a commencement address that went viral, described his fear of being busted by the fraud police, whom he imagined showing up at his door with a clipboard to tell him that he had no right to live the life he was living. Although men do report feeling like imposters, the experience is primarily associated with women, and the word imposter has been granted special feminized forms, impostrix, impostress, since the 1600s. Clance and Imes remain stunned by how broadly their idea has circulated. We had no idea, Imes said. We were just as surprised as everyone else. But their ambitions were never small. We saw suffering in a lot of people, and we hoped we could help, Imes told me. We wanted to change people's lives. Clance lives in a craftsman bungalow in Druid Hills, a leafy Atlanta neighborhood. When I visited, the first thing I noticed in the front hallway was a wooden statue of a naked woman triumphantly holding a mask above her head. Masks feature prominently in Clance's writing on the imposter phenomenon. Her book has three main sections, putting on the mask, the personality behind the mask, and taking off the mask, and argues that imposter feelings come from a conviction that I have to mask who I am. Now 84 years old, Clance has a slight, bird-like frame and is nimble-minded and affable. Draped in a wool blanket and sipping on a protein shake, she told me about years of therapeutic work with clients experiencing the imposter phenomenon, work that often focused on early family dynamics. Clance and Imes' original paper identified two distinct family patterns that gave rise to imposter feelings. Either women had a sibling who had been identified as the smart one, or else they themselves had been identified as superior in every way, intellect, personality, appearance, talent. The pair theorized that women in the first group are driven to find the validation they didn't get at home, but end up doubting whether validation later comes their way. Those in the second group encounter a disconnect between their parents' unrealistic faith in their capacities and the experience of fallibility that life inevitably brings. For both types of imposters, the crisis comes from the disjunction between the messages received from their parents and the messages received from the world. Are my parents right that I'm inadequate? Or is the world right that I'm capable? Or conversely, are my parents right that I'm perfect? Or is the world right that I'm failing? This gap gives rise to conviction that either the parent is wrong or the world is wrong. The imposter begins to do everything possible to prevent being discovered in her self-perceived deficiency. Clance and Imes cite one client who, as a child, pretended to be sick for three consecutive Fridays when spelling bees were held. She could not bear the thought of her parents finding out she could not win the spelling contest. Another client pretended to be playing with art supplies instead of studying whenever her mother walked into the room, because her mother had taught her that naturally smart people don't have to study. Clance and Imes describe the cycle that imposter feelings often produce, a sense of impending failure that inspires frenzied hard work and short-lived gratification when failure is staved off, quickly followed by the return of the old conviction that failure is imminent. Some women adopt a kind of magical thinking about their pessimism, daring to believe in success would actually doom them to failure, so failure must be anticipated instead. The typical case hides her own opinions, fearing that they will be seen as stupid. She might seek the approval of a mentor, but then believe it has been secured only because of charm or appeal. She may hate herself for even needing this validation, taking the need itself as proof of her intellectual phoniness. Repeated successes usually don't break the cycle, Clance and Imes emphasize. All the frenzied efforts and mental calculations that are directed into preventing the discovery of one's inadequacy and fraudulent ultimately just reinforce the belief in this inadequate, fraudulent version of the self. Clance has seen clients healed not by success, but by the kind of resonance she found with Imes. Bolstered and sustained by group therapy with other women, it's easier to believe other women aren't imposters. They can bring, then, this recognition of others' delusion back to themselves. Sometimes Clance asks clients to keep a notebook recording how they deflected compliments, reminding me of a woman who tweeted about reckoning with imposter feelings by creating a file on her computer called Evidence I'm Not an Idiot. Clance also gave clients homework assignments, such as asking them to study for only 6 hours for an upcoming test rather than 12. The mere idea of this gave me a pang of anxiety, and I ventured that it would be terrible if they ended up failing as a result. And she nodded, "Yep, then you really set them back." In 2020, almost 50 years after Clance and Imes collaborated on their article, another pair of women collaborated on an article about imposter syndrome, this one pushing back fiercely against the idea. In Stop Telling Women They Have Imposter Syndrome, published in the Harvard Business Review in February 2021, Ruchika Tulsyan and Jody Ann Burry argue that the label implies that women are suffering from a crisis of self-confidence and fails to recognize the real obstacles facing professional women, especially women of color. Essentially, that it reframes systemic inequality as an individual pathology. As they put it, quote, imposter syndrome directs our view toward fixing women at work instead of fixing the places where women work, end quote. Tulsyan started hearing the term a decade ago when she left a job in journalism to work in the Seattle tech industry. She was attending women's leadership conferences where it seemed that everyone was talking about imposter syndrome and the confidence gap. But no one was talking about gender bias and systemic racism. She got tired of hearing women, especially white women, her own heritage as Indian Singaporean, comparing notes on who had the most severe imposter syndrome. It seemed like another version of women sharing worries about their weight, a kind of communal self-deprecation that reiterated oppressive metrics rather than disrupting them. During the early pandemic, she met up with Burry, another woman of color working in Seattle Tech, for an outdoor lunch, and they compared notes on their shared frustration with the idea of imposter syndrome. There was a tremendous feeling of relief and resonance. As Tulsyan put it, it was like everybody is telling you the sky is green, and suddenly you tell your friend, I think the sky is blue, and she sees it this way as well. Burry, who was born in Jamaica, didn't feel like an imposter. She felt enraged by the systems that had been built to disenfranchise her. She also didn't experience any yearning to belong, to inhabit certain spaces of power. White women want to access power. They want to sit at the table, she told me. Black women say, this table is rotten. This table is hurting everyone. She resisted knee-jerk empowerment rhetoric that seemed to encourage a damaging bravado. I didn't want to beef up myself to inflict more harm. At their lunch, Tulsiyan mentioned that she was writing a piece about imposter syndrome, and Bure immediately asked her, "Did you read the original article?" Like Adira Landry, Bure had felt impelled to look it up and had been struck by its limitations. "It wasn't a clinical study, but a set of anecdotal observations," she told Tulsiyan, "largely gleaned from high-achieving white women who had received much affirmation from the world." "I must have spoken for 20 minutes uninterrupted, Bure recalled. After that, Tulsiyan said, "It's done. We're collaborating." Like Clance and Imes, Tulsiyan and Bure recognized in each other versions of the feelings that they themselves had been harboring. Only these were feelings about the world rather than about their psyches. They were sick of people talking about women having imposter syndrome rather than talking about biases in hiring, promotion, leadership, and compensation. They came to believe that a concept designed to liberate women from their shame, to help them confront the delusion of their own insufficiency, had become yet another way to keep them disempowered. When I asked Clance and Imes about Tulsiyan and Bure's critiques, they agreed with many of them, conceding that their original sample and parameters were limited. Although their model had actually acknowledged, rather than obscured, the role that external factors played in creating imposter feelings, it focused on things such as family dynamics and gender socialization rather than on systemic racism and other legacy of inequality. But they also pointed out that the popularization of their idea as a syndrome had distorted it. "Every time Imes hears the phrase imposter syndrome, she told me it lodges in her gut. It's technically incorrect and conceptually misleading. As Clance explained, the phenomenon is an experience rather than a pathology. And their aim was always to normalize this experience rather than to pathologize it. Their concept was never meant to be a solution for inequality and prejudice in the workplace, a task for which it would necessarily prove insufficient. Indeed, Clance's own therapeutic practice was anything but oblivious of the external structural forces highlighted by Tulsiyan and Bure. When mothers came to Clance describing their imposter feelings around parenting, her advice was not, "Work on your feelings." It was, "Get more child care." Tulsiyan and Bure never anticipated how much attention their article would receive. It has been translated and published all over the world, and is one of the most widely shared articles in the history of the Harvard Business Review. They heard from people who had been given negative performance evaluations that featured euphemism for imposter syndrome, lacks confidence, or lacks executive presence, and even more refused promotions on these grounds. The diagnosis has become a cultural force fortifying the very phenomenon it was supposed to cure. Rushika Tulsiyan told me, "If it was up to me, we would do away with the idea of imposter syndrome entirely." Jody Ann Bure allows that the concept has been useful in corporate contexts, offering a shared language for talking about self-doubt and a soft entry into conversations about toxic workplaces, but she too feels it is time to bid it farewell. She wants to say, "Thank you for your 50 years of service," and to start looking directly at systems of bias rather than falsely pathologizing individuals. Is there some version of imposter syndrome that can be salvaged? Pulling back from the corporate world to look at the concept more broadly, it seems clear that the branding of imposter syndrome has done a disservice to the concept as well as to the workplaces it has failed to improve. The tale of these two pairs of women, Clance and Imes formulating their idea in the 70s, and Tulsiyan and Bure pushing back in 2020, belongs to the larger intellectual story of second-wave feminism receiving necessary correctives from the third wave. Much of this corrective work results from women of color asking white feminism to acknowledge a complicated matrix of external forces, including structural racism and income inequality, at play in every internal experience. Identifying imposter feelings does not necessitate denying the forces that produce them. It can, in fact, demand the opposite, understanding that the damage from these external forces often becomes part of the internal weave of the self. Although many of the most fervent critics of imposter syndrome are women of color, it's also the case that many people of color do identify with the experience. In fact, research studies have repeatedly shown that imposter syndrome disproportionately affects them. This finding contradicts what I was told years ago, that imposter syndrome is a white lady problem, and suggests instead that the people most vulnerable to the syndrome are not the first ones it described. If we reclaim the imposter phenomenon from the false category of syndrome, then we can allow it to do the work it does best, which is to depict a particular texture of interior experience, the fear of being exposed as inadequate. As a concept, it is most useful in its particular nuances, not as a vague synonym for insecurity or self-doubt, but as a way to describe the more specific delusion of being a fraud who has successfully deceived some external audience. Understood like this, it becomes an experience not diluted, but defined by its ubiquity. It names the gap that persists between the internal experience of selfhood, multiple, contradictory, incoherent, striated with shame and desire, and the imperative to present a more coherent, composed, continuous self to the world. Imposter feelings often arise most acutely from threshold crossing, from one social class to another, one culture to another, one vocation to another, something akin to what Pierre Bourdieu called the split habitus, the self-dwelling in two worlds at once, the college library and the sawmill, the fancy parties and the pig farm. When I spoke to Stephanie Land, the best-selling author of Made, her memoir about cleaning houses to support herself as a single mother, she described her own imposter feelings as an experience of class whiplash, occupying spaces of privilege after she'd grown famous for writing about economic hardship. Land's observations helped me realize that the imposter phenomenon as a concept effectively functions as an emotional filing cabinet, organizing a variety of fraught feelings that we can experience as we try to reconcile three aspects of our personhood: how we experience ourselves, how we present ourselves to the world, and how the world reflects that self back to us. The phenomenon names an unspoken ongoing crisis arising from the gaps between these various versions of the self, and designates not a syndrome, but an inescapable part of being alive. We're out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it. You'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.